When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart decisions about your money. But first, here's this week's Glinkonomics report, and boy, there is so much happening. The Dow kicked things off by dropping more than 300 points on Monday. We've seen about a year and a half's worth of gains wiped out over the last month. And there doesn't seem to be a quick rebound in sight. In fact, all we're seeing are more signs of anxiety from investors, people very, very nervous about China. This week, the National Association of Realtors reported that pending sales of existing homes dropped by 1.4% in August. And that, they say, is signaling a leveling off of activity in the housing market this summer. And that's interesting because usually you don't see that until September or October. So everybody's getting a little nervous about that as well. And remember what I often say, which is that 9 months before a presidential election cycle, real estate tends to slow anyway, right? I know we're more than 9 months ahead of it right now. In fact, we're more than a year ahead of it. But the signs are already on the wall. Meanwhile, major figures in the financial world are increasingly cautious about the state of the U.S. economy, and they're broadcasting that. Carl Icahn, and there's a lot of mixed feelings about Mr. Icahn, but he publicly said that he sees danger signals ahead. Charles Evans, who's the president of the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank, said this week that he's bearish on raising interest rates and doesn't see inflation justifying a Fed hike until the middle of 2016. Now, I have to tell you, I can't see the Fed waiting until the middle of 2016, because then you'd be just a few weeks in front of the presidential election cycle, and everybody's going to be like, oh, no, the Fed's playing politics. So I don't think we're going to see it go that far. But almost every economist who was polled thought that the Fed was going to raise interest rates this last go around. They didn't raise interest rates because of China and what was going on with the stock market. And so there's a lot of nervousness, a lot of bearishness out there. Now, the federal government has infused billions and billions of dollars into the economy, and the Fed has had its monetary easing policies going full throttle for years, right? You've heard of the QE1, QE2, 3, 4, and we still haven't actually broken out of the economic malaise that we're in. And I do want to say that with all due respect to the fact that the unemployment rate is like at 5.2%, there's still a malaise out there. We're still not growing as fast as we should be. So I want to bring all of that up this week because I'm going to be talking with my guest about some of the big things in the financial system that haven't changed during the Great Recession. We have come a long way since 2008, 2009, but we're still not seeing wages rise significantly, and we aren't seeing the housing market heat up in earnest for anyone other than the wealthiest segment of buyers. New construction is still half of what it should be. So what's holding us back? And is it going to drag our economy into another contraction before we fully recover from the last one? I'd like to know what you think. Please leave your comments under the show notes to this podcast. Let me know what your hope, fears, and dreams and predictions are for the fourth quarter of 2015, and we'll talk about that on upcoming shows. Okay, let's move on to the rest of today's show. I've got a special guest who just wrote a book about the government-sponsored mortgage giants that control most of the secondary mortgage market, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They've been under government conservatorship, ever since 2008 when the housing market crashed. Bethany McLean started looking into the details of the Fannie-Freddie conservatorship in an effort to better understand what happened and why that arrangement is still going on. Her book is called Shaky Ground, The Strange Saga of U.S. Mortgage Giants. And the kicker she found is that we still haven't found a solution to issues in the secondary mortgage market that contributed to the 2008 crash in the first place. Bethany, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So tell me a little bit about why you decided to write this book.
Well, I've been interested in Fannie and Freddie for a really long time. When I first heard about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I thought, how can such a thing exist? Government-sponsored enterprise, what is that? It sounds like some sort of mythical beast. We're supposed to be a capitalist society. Why do we need the government in our housing market? And I followed them through the financial crisis. And then when Columbia Global Reports came to me and said, well, what's the biggest issue remaining from the financial crisis? I said, I can't believe these two companies are still sitting in this state called conservatorship. The big promise of the financial crisis, what was supposed to be the silver lining, was that we would not only rethink Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but we would rethink how we're going to finance housing. It's a very big question, a very important one for all of us, whether you're someone who has a mortgage or is going to get one, whether you're simply an investor, whether you just care about the economy. Homeownership makes up around 15 to 20% of our GDP. It's an enormous issue.
So let's go back to 2008. I mean, the world felt like it was truly falling apart. Nobody wanted to make loans. The loans that people were making were going bad. People had stopped paying their mortgage. We heard all about a new phrase, strategic default. People just sort of opting to say, take my house, I don't really care anymore. What was going on in the secondary mortgage market in 2008?
Well, it's an interesting story, and it doesn't please anybody on either side of the equation. I think the simplistic version of the financial crisis has become, well, it was, if you're on the left, you say it was Wall Street greed. If you're on the right, you say it was all the fault of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And it's almost akin to a religious war, right? Because if you can say it's all the fault of the government, then the simple answer is get the government out of the equation. We don't need any government involvement. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. Fannie and Freddie dove into the business of guaranteeing riskier loans, and they function primarily as an insurer. They guarantee the timely payment of interest and principals on mortgages. And they dove into doing this with riskier mortgages because they were being left behind by the private market, which had really pioneered subprime lending. And these mortgages began to default at astonishing rates, as we saw, and it became clear that Fannie and Freddie were in a precarious situation.
So it's funny, I was actually at the press conference when the former CEO of Fannie Mae, I think it was 1990 or 1991, announced to this huge group that Fannie Mae was going to start buying Alt A or A minus level mortgage-backed securities because it was exactly the same as buying A, and they had done the testing. And I sat there taking notes. I was in the aisle. There were no places to even sit for the reporters in the room. And I thought to myself, wow, this is such a momentous thing that he's saying. I was kind of amazed. And that was all the way back in 1990. And it took all the way until 2008 for that world to kind of build itself up and then fall apart.
Yeah, although I think that's part of the story, definitely. But look, there's a big difference between making a mortgage to somebody who's a slightly weaker credit and doing the kind of lending that led to the collapse. It's a little bit akin to say one is like the other is a little bit akin to saying making a responsible decision to lend your high school senior the car to go for a night out and having them be home at 11 o'clock and with no drinking is the same as giving your car to a teenager after feeding them a case of beer. You know, there's a difference, and it's a really important part of the conversation today about home ownership. And I think it's one that's become sort of politically poisonous because we've equated the two kinds of loans. In the end, if you look at the data, the financial collapse in 2008 wasn't a result of extending home ownership opportunities to people. It was a credit crisis. Most of the risky loans that defaulted in the crisis were so-called cash-out refinancings, where people take out a bigger mortgage and spend the difference in cash. The biggest subprime lender in the country didn't even offer home purchase loans. And there have been some interesting studies showing that most of the defaults have actually come from more affluent buyers. So this is not, the crisis should be a referendum on extending too much credit to people, but I don't think it should be a referendum on home ownership. I'm not saying this home ownership sort of cult that has prevailed in our country since basically its founding, since the 1800s, is necessarily a good thing, but I don't think the crisis proves it one way or the other.
So one point, though, that I think is fair to say, which is that, you know, when the then CEO of Fannie Mae in 1990 or 1991 said that they were going to start taking Alt-A credits, that was a far cry from what it eventually became for everybody, which was no doc loans, you know, people basically lying on their loan forms. We had people doing these sort of opt-arm loans where, you know, you could decide what payment, if any, that you were going to make. People didn't understand. We'd move back into the world of neg-am loans, negative amortization loans, and what that actually really meant. And I watched people in 2004, 5, and 6, you know, with $50,000 maybe of cash income under the table, qualifying for $500,000 loans. And these were supposed to be, you know, like perfect credit loans, when in fact it was if you had a pulse and enough cash to put down, you know, not even put down, but enough cash to pay the fees to the lender, you were getting those loans. And I think you could agree that those loans should never have been made.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Those loans should never have been made. I think the point I'm trying to make is that this was a dangerous confluence of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the private sector. You can't put all the blame on one or the other.
Yeah.
And when you look at a study of comparable loans, the private sector loans have defaulted at something like four times the rate of Fannie and Freddie backed loans. So the riskiest, worst loans were made by lenders, sold through Wall Street, didn't bear Fannie and Freddie's stamp. So it's hard to argue that this whole thing was caused by them, although they certainly participated and made the bubble worse than it would otherwise have been.
So Fannie and Freddie today have, you've written in your book, have managed to achieve a kind of worst of both worlds status. They're too political to be financially secure, too financially insecure to accomplish the mission of providing loans to facilitate home ownership among the lower income and minority borrowers. I think there's also just an issue of, you know, what are you going to do with all of these big time investors who also, by the way, just happen to be big donors to political campaigns, who are now invested in this, what's become basically a penny stock of both companies, putting a huge amount of pressure to get those back traded publicly so they can reap another huge fortune. What do you think is the way forward?
Well,
that's a big question.
No. I think it's just, I mean, who could make up this strange saga, right? So the government, in part because they don't want to put Fannie and Freddie's debt on their balance sheet, it would have added over $5 trillion in debt to our fiscal debt. So they left 20% of Fannie and Freddie's securities outstanding when they took them over and put them into this state called conservatorship. And they even said at the time, the head of Fannie and Freddie's regulator even said at the time, look, this might have value one day. And so smart investors started to do the work and they said, oh, these losses that Fannie and Freddie are declaring, they're not cash losses, they're estimates of future losses. The housing markets are recovering. These aren't going to come to fruition. These two companies are going to be enormously profitable really soon. So we're going to buy these securities. And then in 2012, the government abruptly changed the rules and said, oh, no, we're not just going to collect a dividend on the money we've lent you. We're going to take every dime you ever make into the future. And there's a huge controversy about why this happened. But I mean, can you imagine if this had happened with one of the big banks, if the government, after luring investors in, had said, oh, no, we're taking it over. We're going to take every penny into the future. It's only this sort of strange status of Fannie and Freddie that makes this sort of an under-the-radar scandal. And the big problem that's happened since then is that because the government is taking all of their profits, yet we're still depending on Fannie and Freddie to finance American homeownership, they have over $5 trillion of securities of liabilities outstanding, and they have no capital. So if there's a downturn in the housing market, they have to draw from taxpayers again because they have no capital with which to absorb losses. So it's a very unsustainable and indeed shaky situation. Getting to what I think, I've come to believe that Fannie and Freddie are a bit like Winston Churchill's famous line about democracy. You know, it's the worst of all possible systems with the exception of everything else that ever has been or will be proposed. If there are things that we as Americans want, like a 30-year fixed rate mortgage that's available in good times and bad times, and that's available on a pretty consistent basis to people who are wealthy, to people who are middle class, to people across desirable and undesirable geographies, then you need some kind of government backstop in the market because the private market isn't going to supply that product. Given that, I'm not sure there's a real alternative to Fannie and Freddie, albeit a heavily reformed version of Fannie and Freddie.
So what's interesting about that, at least in my mind, is the idea that big banks have been out there over the last couple of years, and there are four really major banks out there. You've got Wells Fargo, and you've Bank of America, and you've got Citi, and who else? There's a fourth one out there. I don't know.
Wells, Bank of America, JP Morgan, and Citi are really the big four.
They're the big four. And I've heard from all of them talking about how they're going to create their own marketplace, particularly Bank of America and Wells Fargo, and they're going to start doing mortgages, and they're going to provide the liquidity and all this sort of thing. And there are, of course, people in Congress who I wonder if they really understand what they're saying, who are like, oh, we should go that way because it's privatized. But what we had before was privatized. But I agree with you. There needs to be some sort of a federal backstop, because in this world, we still want money to be regularly available. And when you have a credit freeze like you did back in 2008, or you also had the same sort of thing happen in 2001, and there have been other credit freezes as we've gone sort of through past recessions, but it's so interconnected now, right? It's gotten worse and worse. If you want to have some liquidity around that, I do think there has to be a government option. Now, people will say, well, that's what FHA is for. How do you answer that?
Well, I guess I would quibble with the idea that the big banks are a privatized market. The big banks, along with Fannie and Freddie, were too big to fail in 2008, right? It turned out they, too, were
government. Only Lehman was not too big to fail.
It turns out most of them, too, were government-sponsored enterprises. When push came to shove, they needed the government to rescue them as well. Yep. So people would say the new Dodd-Frank legislation fixes that, and now the big banks can fail and they're purely private enterprises. I can promise you, if the big banks hold all the nation's mortgage risk, they will not be allowed to fail when there's a crisis. So then why are they different than Fannie and Freddie? All you're doing is concentrating everything, all the financial risk and all the political power in the hands of a few institutions. Personally, maybe it's just a gut belief. I like the idea of dispersing both the risk and the political power into different and sort of competing hands. I think that helps level it out a little bit more. So I disagree with this idea that a big bank solution is a purely private solution. I can just picture a backroom deal where a congressman wanting to juice the economy in his region says, okay, Mr. Big Bank, you make a bunch of loans in my region and I'll go easy on derivatives legislation in return. I don't like the idea of that kind of backroom deal. I'd rather have a Fannie and Freddie, who are a little bit more transparent than that. I guess as a further point, why can't the FHA just handle it? Then you're arguing, and I think it's very interesting that this often comes out of conservatives' mouths, then you're arguing for a really nationalized function. I don't know why you would want this to be nationalized. You can see already what the Obama administration has done. They're using Fannie and Freddie's profits to reduce the budget deficit. At one point, they raised the guarantee fees that homeowners would pay, essentially increasing mortgage costs in order to fund a payroll tax deduction. I don't like the idea of all of this power over our economy being completely politicized, and I don't understand why people who appear to be free market people would want it to be that politicized either.
So that's an interesting point, because if you've got Fannie and Freddie like in conservatorship and you've got the government taking all of their profits, I sort of see it as, well, they're taking $100 billion in profits. If Fannie and Freddie need to be propped up, they're going to do it anyway. Why not just have the government run it and have lower interest rates and lower costs and have a system that can be arguably more fair with somebody who's actually backing it up? There's so many, and that eliminates some of the other issues, which, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I look at, you know, Fannie and Freddie and tens of millions of dollars being paid to the people who run it. And really, when you start paying people at that kind of level, I think they stop making choices that are in the national good. So if you have people running a secondary mortgage market who are really running it so that it increases the value of their own shares in the company, that is also not so good. It's not so healthy, and it's really not so stable, and it's at risk for bad decision making.
Right, and that's certainly what we saw in the 1990s, right? But right. I guess I would say there's a middle ground to that. You can have a Fannie and Freddie that are public, that aren't nationalized, but that are regulated like a utility with very tight returns, with allowable returns, or that are structured in such a way that their incentive to chase profits is minimized and their incentive to run a stable business is maximized. There are all sorts of ways to structure that. To my mind, and again, this is it becomes a very ideological discussion. recession. But I believe that that's a better solution than having these companies purely nationalized. One, for the reasons I previously articulated, I don't like the idea of mortgage credit being a political football that can be juiced by whoever the current administration is, or turned back by whoever the current administration is. I also think the mortgage market, the American mortgage market, is one of the biggest bond markets in the world. It is fast moving. It is incredibly competitive. It is filled with sharks. The idea that you're going to have a government agency running this and dealing with these guys all the time, the cost to taxpayers is going to be huge. I think you want this staffed with smart people who have an incentive to be somewhat bottom line motivated.
So, and this is why we now understand, because you and I have, you know, reached the same thing. Nobody in Congress has come up with a solution, and there was supposed to be one, like, after 2 or 3 years. So by 2010, 2011, next year we're going to have it. It was 2012, 13, 14, 15. Now we're heading into 16, and there is no real solution on the table. And I think we've now kind of gone over all the reasons why, because there are good and honest things to be said about both sides of the coin. Finding a middle ground that's going to make a highly politicized government work seems to not be quite in the offing yet. And now we're going into an election year where the sides are so polarized, it's really hard to imagine them coming to an agreement about something this important, don't you think?
It is absolutely, and it really is an argument that gets at the heart of what the government's role should be, and that's obviously a deep, incredibly ideologically divisive topic, particularly in our current time. I just say that that's not an excuse for not having a conversation, and for the fact that none of the presidential candidates are even talking about this. Oh, yeah. Look, it's a huge issue. Since the financial crisis, homeownership rates are back down to the levels of the early 1990s when Bill Clinton first became president. Some people might say that's a good thing. Homeownership was too high. We should have a lower homeownership rate. That's fine, except people have to live somewhere. They have to put their head on a pillow somewhere at night. And at the same time as this has happened, and the rate has fallen particularly steeply in minority communities, now rental rates are surging. Yeah. And so you've got a huge affordability question that's both a big question for our economy, it's a big question for our young people, and it's a big question for our social fabric. And I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I'm sure that not talking about it and ignoring it and keeping Fannie and Freddie in this unsustainable limbo is most definitely not the right answer.
It probably isn't. Bethany, thank you so much. So insightful to hear, you know, the results of all of your research and the thoughts that you bring forward. I really appreciate it. Bethany McLean is the author of Shaky Ground, The Strange Saga of the U.S. Mortgage Giants. Where can we get your book?
You can get it on Amazon. There is a Kindle version available. You can get it in Barnes & Noble bookstores and in other bookstores. So it's a short read. It's published by Columbia Global Reports, which is a new imprint out of Columbia University that's aiming to take on important topics, but in a shorter form. So it's a heavy topic, but the length makes it fairly digestible.
I know. I was looking at it going, why can't I write a smart book this short?
You absolutely could. I
promise. They're all a little bit too long. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I want to send a big thank you to Bethany McLean for being on the show. If there was anything you missed, please don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. If you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet on iTunes, please, you should do that. Then you'll find out every time we post. And please consider giving this show a ratings or review when you're there. And if you don't know how to get there, search for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, or just Google it. You should also check out my other podcast, Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne, for some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. It is awesome for anybody who is a small or medium-sized business owner, or anybody who just wants a little extra branding help. You can find that also in the iTunes section or on the blog section of my digital content agency website, thinklinkmedia.com. All right, everybody. That brings us to the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.